Hi, it's Tony Bruschi from Real Ghost Stories Online, inviting you to subscribe to our other podcast called The Grave Talks. It's where I sit down and interview individuals who've had extreme paranormal situations happen to them in their lives. Just search The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Be sure to press subscribe and give us some stars to help spread the word that this show exists. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of The Grave Talks. Today on The Grave Talks, demonic artifacts. Can historic artifacts still hold demons conjured up by ancient civilizations? What power can these entities hold over the living in the present? From demons, djinns, possession, sinister artifacts, and gruesome archaeological discoveries, Dr. Heather Lynn has been seeking out answers to these questions for quite some time. Today on The Grave Talks, we discuss the lore behind real relics believed to be the cause of hauntings and demonic possession. We also discuss the possibility of modern objects holding spirits and a message for the living. Can the archaeological record prove the existence of demons and malevolent entities?
I am an author, historian, and some call renegade archaeologist. What I do is I look into alternative sort of fringe topics, things that are outside the mainstream narrative, anything from, you know, paleo contact theory, which some people would call ancient aliens, to just mythology, folklore, symbolism, consciousness, so many different things that most people would consider a little strange. So my background is that I started actually in community college. I earned an associate's degree in archaeology and worked in archaeology and continued my studies into anthropology and earned a master's in history. My thesis actually examined the intersection of class inequality, consumer culture, propaganda, and public education, and how all of those things sort of met in early modern Europe. So nothing too, you know, outrageous or strange. Sure. Pretty, you know, common, predictable path of specialization. I went on to pursue a doctorate in education at the University of New England. In that dissertation, I raised the questions about whether or not digital technologies and museums really, you know, benefited anybody or not. I looked at the way public education in museums was handled, and basically, you know, it was something close to my heart, because you go to a lot of the museums these days and you want to see artifacts. And a lot of times, I don't know if anybody's noticed this, but sometimes the museums are lighter on artifacts than they used to be. And instead, they have a lot of these gamified systems or interactive things. And, you know, while that's all fun, it replaced the traditional artifacts. And sometimes, a lot of times, surprisingly, people go looking for the artifacts, and what they'll find in its place are, you know, reproductions. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was just something that, you know, I kind of have always had a passion for, fighting for the public education of history. When I was a kid, I hated history. I really hated it. It was the most boring thing to me. I wasn't very good at rote memorization, so I didn't like names and dates and memorizing those sorts of things. And I just really hated history with a passion. I was a musician, and so that's what I thought I was going to go into. And, you know, so I was like, no, history's not for me. But I actually, my divergence from mainstream anything, I think, started when I was a teenager, because I actually didn't finish high school. I left home and traveled the country just exploring and looking for answers and seeking new religious paths. And I was just kind of out there. And so I didn't follow those dreams of becoming a classical musician or anything like that. Instead, I just thought, I'm hightailing it out of here. And you know, that doesn't make for a very good future. And so once I got my act together, I went back to school and did the, you know, right thing and got myself back into a path of a more successful, you know, ordinary, you know, journey of education. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just take some things I'm interested in. And I hadn't considered history because, it was so boring.
Sure.
But I loved history. And that was the weird thing, that it didn't even occur to me how much I loved history, that, you know, I loved archaeology. When I was really little, I used to go next door to a house that had been torn down where the foundation had been left. And I used to pretend I was excavating. I would pick up all kinds of little pieces of garbage, essentially. And I thought I was on adventures. And I loved the idea of the past and documentaries. And I guess I was called, you know, an armchair historian at that point. Mm-hmm. And it just never occurred to me that I could actually do something with that until I went back to school and started taking those classes and learning about history in a new way that wasn't based in the rote memorization or the information coming from the authorities at the top down to the people. And the more I got into that, and the more I, you know, again, I was innocent and wanting to always do the right thing and go on the right path, I started seeing a lot of corruption. And when I started working in archaeology, I saw more and more corruption, and not just corruption in the sense of, you know, funding issues or those political issues. While those are very much real and, you know, but almost maybe expected, sadly, I started seeing things that didn't really sit well with me in a philosophical way. The idea of, you know, some history just shouldn't be shared because people couldn't handle it, mm-hmm. or we shouldn't look into it, or there's no place for this, just disregard it. In fact, don't write it in the report. Just things like that. And the more and more I got into it, the more I thought, this is kind of weird. Finally, you know, I worked in some museums and did things, and I ended up, you know, getting another doctorate in comparative religion and just some certificates here and there to specialize in osteoarchaeology and archaeoastronomy. And so I'm a lifelong learner. I believe in continuing education and never stopping, but I believe that it's important to educate yourself in order to pursue the things you're interested in and not the things that you think might get the best chance of funding. And so it's just basically a philosophy that I didn't agree with. And so I couldn't find that it meshed well with my values. And then I just decided, you know what? I'm not doing this. It's not worth it to me. And I'm going to pursue my interest full time in all of these strange and interesting subjects. And I'm very glad. So far, that's what I've been doing. And I couldn't be happier.
When it comes to being into the field or digging into the field, and you were getting some of that pushback as you were entering it, and you were hearing pushback like, oh, this shouldn't be shared with the public, they can't handle it. Well, give me an example of one of those things that stood out to you at first that you were kind of like, really? So we shouldn't talk about this?
Yeah, and that was really something that was, you know, I was working in an urban environment. I was working in community archaeology. I did a lot with, you know, disadvantaged youth. In the summer, we did a program, the lab did a program where we were trying to help young people from an urban environment understand that there's still history underneath their feet, that, you know, it doesn't matter. A lot of movies and things will show archaeology as something that's out in the desert or these exotic places. And while that's totally true, there's more to archaeology. And that's what we were trying to, you know, impart on the kids. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we wanted to show them, you know, why it's important to value that history. And so it was a really wonderful program when we're, you know, doing these sorts of things. And so you wouldn't think that anything in that would breed any sort of controversy, at least in terms of the artifacts found. So that's probably what made it even more weird to me. So, and maybe I was inclined, you know, honestly, my bias was already there, being that I was interested in alternative ideas. But so we're going, and one excavation in particular, we are literally excavating within the metropolitan area, downtown, like right in the heart of downtown. Mm-hmm. And what we were finding were, we were doing some research in some of the homesteads, the early homesteads of the Rockefellers, and, you know, because Cleveland, they had a lot of homes and different things, and, you know, clearly there's an impact there. So, you know, we were just doing some things to look at how urban sprawl, suburban sprawl, you know, how did things happen at the turn of the century and, you know, earlier, and just very basic things. So we were looking, and, you know, we were in a privy, and I found a lot of bottles of this Mrs. Winslow soothing syrup, and it's something that I took some time studying, and it was fascinating. It's this this bottle of syrup. It was one of these old time medicines that had opioids and cocaine, you know, you'd expect.
Sure.
And they would say one bottle would last the kid an entire lifetime, or all of your kids, because, you know, essentially you give them a little bit and that's all it took, and you shouldn't, you know, one bottle's enough, so just buy one bottle. Well, the thing is, you know, we kept finding a lot of bottles, huge stashes of these bottles in individual homes. So, you know, these, like, each home would have just tons of bottles thrown out that they were, you know, past the age of the kid too. Like, wait a minute, what's going on? And then I took a look at this, and it wasn't very interesting to most people, but my ideas and the things that I ended up following in, you know, my master's program was the idea of propaganda, or using marketing and advertising to, you know, control people, even in the earliest sense before it was propaganda. And so I started looking at the advertising methods of, you know, this particular pharmaceutical. And it, well, they hardly advertised what it did for the child. Most of the time, what was going on in the later years was it was showing these, you know, Victorian women that were decked out in very much, you know, leisurely pose on a bed. And it was just talking about how luxurious they'd feel. And it was hinting around at a lot of things. And the more I researched, the more I found that there were discussions and even, you know, hearings on this particular pharmaceutical company and how the government forever knew that this product was very dangerous, obviously, and it was not being marketed or sold with the intention of actually being used for the children as much as it was being used as a drug for the moms. And they were advertising this glamorous lifestyle of the mothers, you know, who would just, they'd be high on this all day, and that's why there were so many bottles. And it was coincidental because, you know, in the area, it was actually close to one of the very first, if not the very first, woman's only opioid clinics. And so, and I'm looking at this and I'm like, wow, this is nuts. You know, it's just not that big a deal. Not, I wouldn't say controversial much. And, it was like, oh yeah, well, you know, how about not? Like, wait a minute, what? I have this great research project, this paper, look at this. This is amazing. I had some, you know, bottle specialists. I had people lined up, and it was like, yeah, we don't think we should put that out. Like, wait, what are you talking about? Opinions here? That really struck me as odd. Like, why? Tell me why. Why shouldn't we put this out there? Like, it's research. It should just be objective. This does not compute. And it's, you know, it was just left at that until one evening, you know, we were at a restaurant, had a few drinks going, and, you know, talking about fundraising for the lab. And then it was told to me, well, you know, the people who pay, the people who were trying to appeal for the funds, the quote stakeholders, that was always a term thrown around with stakeholders. They want a certain thing found and a certain thing not. And that's really what we need to focus on. And it was just like the honesty started flowing. And, you know, little things like that just started getting me to think, well, this is a silly little, this was at a community college. I was like, it was a huge community college, but I was like, this is at a community college in an urban environment. This isn't groundbreaking. Well, no pun intended. This isn't groundbreaking stuff. And yet we're beholden to these mysterious stakeholders for what? I don't even know the end game here. And it was so compartmentalized. And all I could think was, if it's this bad here, then what's going on elsewhere? Mm-hmm. And then that's, you know, I had that thought. And, you know, some years later, that's when, you know, I started researching a little more of the, I guess, the idea of stakeholders and the corruption in that side of things, and or on that side of things. And that's what led me to put out my report, The Sumerian Controversy. And that's when I started, you know, looking into who's funding major excavations in the Middle East. Because, again, I thought, if this is happening in, a, you know, basically a small urban center, now, what over these small issues, these are not big issues, and what other meddling is going on with the quote stakeholders? What is the state of this quote science? You know, what is happening here? And so I really got more and more interested in looking at the, you know, the money end of it and trying to find what's really going on here. And that's when I started to find that, you know, there's excavations happening in the Middle East that are funded by what you'd think would be universities. And then you find out, well, who's funding the grants and the foundation and the lab, and who's really funding that aspect of the university. And then you find that it's big oil companies, or maybe possibly worse, depending on your, you know, how you look at things, private collectors of antiquities. So that right there is like, wait a minute. So you're telling me if You know, in this particular one that I wrote about with Thyssen from the Thyssen family dynasty, he is considered having the largest collection of antiquities, except for the queen. They don't know if he or the queen of England actually, who has the most antiquities. So they just don't know for sure, but he's right up there. So if we're talking major collector, and he's the one who has laundered money through different foundations and going through to sprinkle it down into the university system it's this way of taking money from the top and sprinkling it down so that people that are on the ground, like some of the archaeologists, they don't really know who's funding this. They just think, well, I'm working for the university. It's the university. There's grants, sure, but there's so much compartmentalization and corruption going on in that to me, that's just an absolute conflict of interest to think that, okay, we have this hugely powerful billionaire figure who collects antiquities for himself so that he can have them in his living room, literally. And he even stated in an interview, this Thyssen in particular, he stated in an interview that, wow, I couldn't believe that you could just buy these things.
I hope you enjoyed your 15-minute preview of our new podcast, The Grave Talks. Be sure to subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download podcasts to not miss any episode of the show. New episodes every single Monday. Just search for The Grave Talks and then press subscribe. Give us a review while you're at it and some stars that will help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that the show exists to make an even better show for you. The Grave Talks. Check it out at thegravetalks.com.